This week, we pool our money to buy a single share of Facebook stock. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen,
ladies and gentlemen,
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen,
ladies and gentlemen,
I have the pleasure to present to you
the Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
to remind
Process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome now. To episode 28. The kids call it the process. Today is May 2nd?
It is.
2012. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
This is Rob.
And we are back after taking a week off there. But we are continuing with our series on the three principles, what we're calling My Manifesto. This is part two this week. And as you'll recall, last week we covered part one, which was All Men Are Created Equal. We got a fair amount of feedback on that, so we'll be covering that later. But right now we're going to jump into part two, my second principle, which is that the initiation of force is immoral. So let me take a minute here to set this up, unless you guys have comments already.
We disagree.
Okay.
Yeah, I think everybody needs a good beat down every now and then. So.
Okay. So let me outline this a little bit. To start off with, I think that our notion of laws and the rule of law are an attempt by humans to codify what each of us is kind of born knowing already. All right. So our behavior towards each other is governed by something called natural law. And natural law is a product of who we are as humans. Okay, it's a result of human nature, and I think it evolved in us right alongside our ability to throw rocks accurately. And I know it sounds kind of strange, but the reason I say that is, without these abilities, we would not live as long. And so we'd be at an evolutionary disadvantage if we couldn't hunt and if we couldn't judge the moral character of people around us so that, you know, we could avoid those who mean to do us harm. If we weren't able to judge the behaviors of others. So I think judging the morality of that behavior of other people around us is something that we all have the ability to do. Okay, so now some will try to refute that, but I would say that if it's not true, then our current justice system is predicated on this ability that we can take 12 people and put them on a jury and expect them to judge the morality of the actions of a defendant and then render a decision about that. So I think if we're not capable of making those judgments, then our entire justice system is a sham, and we're better off just flipping a coin to determine the outcome of the trial.
I think we could present a few cases where that is true, though, in the last 10 years or 15 years.
That what is true?
That would prove that those 12 people don't have the faculties necessary to judge properly.
Well, I'm not saying that, you know, when you select 12 people at random from a population that you're not occasionally going to get a jury full of morons.
Okay.
That I'm not saying that. But I'm saying, you know, as a whole, the human population has this ability.
Okay.
And so you're generally going to have a jury that's capable of it. But what examples did you have in mind?
Well, Ken's story.
Yeah. <okay.
laughs> Of course, that was really just one guy.
Right.
I don't know how much we want to elaborate on that for the listeners.
I don't know that we've ever told that story on the show.
Yeah. some people would say the O.J. trial, the Casey Anthony trial, maybe William Kennedy Smith, maybe I'm reaching here, and I don't have any other great examples right at my fingertips.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, if you went back through history, I'm sure you could find enough examples of miscarriages of justice and, you know, be able to point the finger at the jury, but...
Okay, go on.
Okay. So anyway, our laws that we, using we loosely here, the laws that are written by politicians, sometimes those laws are incongruent with natural law. And we judge the laws themselves to be immoral, okay? An example of that is the fugitive slave laws from back in the Civil War. And for anybody not familiar with the fugitive slave laws, those were laws that said that anybody that found a runaway slave was obligated to return him or her to their owner. And anybody that failed to do that could be prosecuted under these fugitive slave laws. Those laws were eventually repealed, and one of the main reasons for that was juries all across the northern states were refusing to convict anybody that was being prosecuted for that because, you know, they felt that slavery was immoral. So people who were returning slaves were performing an immoral act, so they refused to convict people who did not return the slaves. Okay, so that's an example of an immoral law that, you know, gets judged by this higher standard of natural law.
I think that would be an interesting exercise to try to enumerate laws that are propped up, immoral laws that are propped up by other immoral laws.
Mm. Oh, yeah, and there's a lot of them. we could do a whole show just about that.
I think something else about your claim there is I wish we had a good hearty evangelical on the program. Maybe we'll invite one, because we're all in agreement there. But I think you would get some raised eyebrows about your hierarchy of natural above biblical laws, as many times in the Bible, slavery is kind of like an A-OK thing.
Right.
So you're talking about what you sense as a natural right that even supersedes what the Bible says. And that will get you cast out of the country. Sorry. We'll see you later.
Yeah, you could be right. There's a lot of different reasons to disagree with this, I guess, and that's one of them.
Yeah, and your fellow podcasters here are not going to quibble with your claim there, but I know a lot of people who would.
Yeah, well, if there's anybody listening out there that has that point of view, please feel free to voice it. Let us hear it.
Would you say the Bible is written by man, or is that directly the word of God then? You would have to say it's the word of God to say that the Bible supersedes natural law.
Of course. It's the inerrant text.
Well, but for it to have any meaning at all, yes, you have to assume it's the word of God.
It's not like a book written by a bunch of dudes, like the Hunger Games. Is that written by a bunch of dudes? I obviously haven't
actually
read it.
Written by one woman, but I got your point. Okay, so there are some laws that we judge to be immoral. Other laws actually reinforce our understanding of natural law. So things like murder and rape, we declare those to be immoral. And you know, there's no disagreement on that because that matches what we know to be true. There's a third class, then, of laws, and I'll just say those are victimless crimes, and that's actually part of my third principle, so we're not going to cover those right now. But so all of that is background to this. The common thread, then, that runs through all of the behaviors that are defined to be immoral by natural law is the initiation of force. So just about any crime that you can come up with involves the initiation of force against someone or some group of people. And the important point here is that it's the initiation of force, not just the use of force. So self-defense is okay.
Because that would be acting against someone else's immoral...
And to someone else who initiated force against you.
Yes.
And that's an important point that a lot of people, I mean, that's the difference between a libertarian and a pacifist, right? Because the pacifist says you can't use force at any time.
And can you define force? Is it strictly physical?
No.
Okay.
I would say, you know, just the threat of force against someone, you know, assault.
Okay, but the threat of physical force, the threat of physical harm, or is it...
No, it wouldn't have
to. This guy's been pestering the hell out of me, and I've told him to stop, I've tried various means, now it's just time to deck this guy.
I think fraud fits into that, you know, it's sort of an intellectual force then, it's, you know, misleading somebody into doing something that will benefit you
at their
peril. So I, you know, in my opinion, all of those crimes then are the result of one party initiating force against another.
Okay.
So I would finish this up by quoting George Washington, who said that government is not reason, it is not eloquence, it is force. So at its most fundamental level, government is force. That's all it can claim to be. And so I find it interesting that when force is used in response to someone's unlawful behavior, we say that the government has done a good thing. But what about when the government initiates force against one of its own citizens that has done nothing to deserve it? I say that action is also immoral, regardless of the fact that it's the government who was the actor.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If you disagree with that, I think that would imply that because a body has been anointed with some power, that it's like the equivalent of diplomatic immunity.
Yeah.
And I don't believe in that at all, especially, you know, if you've seen Lethal Weapon 2, then...
Well, that's pretty much all you got to say about that, right?
Right.
There's your argument. You win. Okay, so the practical point of all of what I just said is that for a law to be legitimate, it must be congruent with natural law and not violate the rights of the individual.
The rights or the liberties?
Yes.
Which one?
Well, we'll get into that when we... cover our listener feedback.
Okay.
So, what do you guys think about that?
Well, Rob, do you want to respond or?
I have thoughts forming. They're like little baby thoughts. They're not quite fully grown.
Okay.
Well, you're a Democrat, so that's expected. I think I agree more than I thought I would, but I still have some questions.
Okay.
Does this rule out the death penalty?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I mean, you don't have the right to take someone else's life. We call that murder.
Hmm.
Hmm. Take that one. Take that, Jeremy.
I don't know. That's tough.
Make your thoughts baby-like.
I'm struggling. I'm struggling.
Because you like the death penalty.
Yeah.
I don't like it, but there comes a point when I think, okay, this person has decided that they don't want to be part of humanity.
Right. And
they aren't good enough to take themselves out, so we should do that for them.
that is a tempting way to approach it, I think. I used to be in favor of the death penalty. I thought, you know, there are some crimes that are just so heinous that is, you know, the only punishment that fits the crime, right?
Yes.
Okay, but the problem with that is justice is not about punishment, and it's not about revenge. Those two things can't enter into the debate about justice. So I view capital punishment as nothing more than a revenge killing, and you know, the only person or persons it benefits are the, you know, the relatives or friends or whatever of the victim. You know, they might get some some little rush out of watching the murderer or the rapist or whatever get fried in the electric chair. But justice is not served by that.
But could you argue that we've talked about this before, and I think your definition of justice, or the whichever you want to say, is that it makes the victim whole.
Right.
Right? Okay.
To the fullest extent possible.
To the fullest extent possible. Is there an emotional equivalent to that, that as a victim, I can't be whole again if I feel this person is still there and it's almost taunting me or it's a threat to me? I still have this fear that this person will get out of prison or do something and come after me, and I'm not going to be whole until that threat is taken away.
I'd say that on a case-by-case basis, I would be willing to entertain that notion.
Okay. And one case I think of is the family, I don't know if it was in Connecticut, it was up east somewhere. The father, it was a home invasion, went wrong. These two guys ended up killing a wife and two daughters of this doctor. He was the only one who survived. And it was a heinous, they set the house on fire, and I mean, it was just a prolonged, almost like a hostage situation, and cases like that are so awful that those are the kind to me that I look at and say, okay, this is where the death penalty becomes an option.
Right. It's the he needed killing defense, right? You've heard that, right?
Well, that's...
But I guess it's more popular in the South, but, you know.
There's a lot of wisdom in the South, you know. Not all on board with everything they come up with, but...
In response to what you said, is there a scenario you could envision where someone is being victimized, perhaps over and over again, by, you know, some individual? And, you know, it becomes apparent at some point that as long as that person is alive, they are going to continue persecuting or, you know, victimizing that other person.
Mm-hmm.
Then, yeah. I mean... you know, especially if it ever comes to a confrontation, and, you know, that escalates into a use of lethal force.
Yes.
You're talking about people that are already locked up, right? I mean, if you want to go to the extreme, we're talking more about people that have already been convicted. Now what do you do with them?
Well, I think we probably talked about that on a previous episode, didn't we, about my ideas for how justice should be served by, you know, either a debtor's prison or, you know, you put them in jail and you make them work and they give their money to the victim's family or their friends or whoever the jury decides is owed that money. And, but, you know, it's not going to bring somebody back who was murdered, obviously. It's not going to restore somebody emotionally who was raped or went through some other traumatic crime.
And in fact, it could be,
but it's
salt in the wound.
Well,
because, oh great, I have this check coming in from this person who committed this disgusting act against me. This is, you want to call it blood money or, you know, dirty money, whatever you want to call it. I want nothing to do with this money.
Okay, well, so give it to charity. Do something.
But it's still do something good with it. You're still having to deal with it. You're still
okay.
You can, well, then turn it down. But it's it's the system forcing something on you that you don't want.
It would not be forced upon you. I mean, this would totally be at the discretion of the victim or the victim's family in the case of somebody who's murdered. You know,
they turn down the money, so what's going to make them whole in place of that?
Because the murderer or the rapist or whoever is going to sit in jail under our current system and do nothing, right?
Right.
So there's absolutely no benefit to anybody in that scenario. But at least this way, somebody may be benefiting from the fact that they've locked this guy up. And if, you know, if it is a situation where getting a check every month from the prison, you know, because this guy's working off his, quote, debt to society, that debt to society is actually his debt to the victim's family. And a jury decides what that debt is.
But how can a jury tell, how can a jury decide that this will make this victim whole?
Well, how do they do it now? I mean, jury.
Well, I don't know that they do.
Juries decide judgments now for things like this. I mean, not the case of a murder necessarily, but, you know, if somebody's maimed, you know, and someone else is found criminally negligent, there's always some kind of monetary reward, and it's the jury who decides the amount.
Yeah, but I'm not saying our current system is abiding by your philosophy here.
No, I'm not either. I'm just saying this is not unprecedented to expect a jury to decide how, you know, what's the right dollar figure. And you know, I know that's somewhat crass to try to put a dollar amount on it, but we do it now. So it can't be that crass.
Well, it can be.
Well, maybe it is.
I mean, just go back to your slavery and the fugitive slave laws. Those, we would consider that crass, those laws. But they were exercised for a while, no?
So you're saying that the jury should never award a monetary value to the plaintiff?
I'm not saying they should never. I'm saying they need to figure out what is going to make this plaintiff whole.
Okay, well,
according to your rules of justice.
At its core, the pursuit of justice is based upon the victim's right to be compensated, all right?
Yes.
Their right to be made whole, okay? And so it is up to the victim or their family, their estate, whatever, to decide what is going to make them whole. And if they decide that they just want this guy locked up for 20 years, then fine. That's, you know, that's all that happens from their point of view. But this guy is going to go to, you know, under my proposed system, this guy is going to go to a debtor's prison, and he's going to work, and he's going to earn a salary while he's in there. That money's going to go somewhere. So the family might as well decide where they want the money to go, you know, donate it to the American Heart Association or something, or, you know, open up a trust fund that, in the victim's name and put the money in that, or, you know.
Yeah, we're kind of going in money. Circles here. We're kind of going in circles here, I think. Rob?
Yeah. I guess I didn't know we were going to get into the punishment thing. I mean, that is a whole topic. I often think like, The whole idea of prison is just a strange idea. It's a very primitive concept.
Yeah.
Like, you stole money, so now you have to sit in a box. It's almost like we don't know what to do with you, so we'll just do this simple thing.
Right. You stole money, so why don't we just make you earn the money and give it back to the person you stole it?
Right. There's no punishment fits the crime. It's just you have to sit in this. Like think of Blagojevich, right?
Yeah.
So he was a corrupt politician. So now he has to sit in a tiny box. Doesn't make any sense.
No, usually they let him sit in an Oval Office. Sorry.
You must be talking about W.
Talking about all of them.
Yeah. So that's just an odd concept. Anyway, I guess I suffer from the elementary thought that if I feel myself a lefty leaner, then anything that confuses me must be a right-wing thought, which this is. So I keep thinking in terms of this is probably more for a Jeremy than a Jerry. But I guess I was sort of fascinated by the kind of the twisting of kind of the Darwinism we usually hear from the right wing. Which is kind of a feeling like survival of the fittest. Everything's a competition. Whoever wins thrives. Whoever doesn't, you know, whether it's business or people or your grandma, doesn't matter. Everything's a battle. And as long as there's fair competition, of course, which there's not. But the idea is, as long as everybody's competing, then everything will be maximally efficient and awesome. And which is more of a right-wing thought than a libertarian thought, I think, or anarchist thought. But I think you're kind of twisting it on its head in that, because the use of force in a primitive sense, the use of force is Darwin winning. This platypus is going to kick your platypus's butt. It's got a big old bill. Yeah. You know, that's Darwinism in action. And I think we sometimes are tweaking exactly how Darwinist we want our society to be. You know, if you're sick and you cost a lot of money out of my pocket, why do I have to pay for your stuff? I'm living large over here.
Right.
You know, that's my right. That's my money. I don't have any obligation to you.
Or I'm not living large. I'm trying to scrape by, yet somebody's still trying to take more from me.
Exactly. Or whatever it is.
Well,
see how I just dismissed that with it, or whatever it is.
Yeah, with exactly. Like you totally agree when in fact you don't, and
just on. Gloss it over. Just yeah, gloss it over.
Use a lot of gloss on that left side there.
So yeah, I guess that was. It sounds like a almost. Yeah, I'm certainly not a Darwinist type argument. Whereas what I it's almost a lefty liberal argument, an idea of that common men have common responsibilities to each other. That preclude just how strong you are, or how much force you have, whether that force is strength and big biceps like me, or whether it's economic strength. Okay. Yeah, lay that on you. If it made any sense.
I don't know what you were arguing for there.
Well,
I'm not really arguing for anything. I'm place the thought into the left right spectrum. And it's almost an anti right wing thought what Jerry's talking about.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to fit onto that two dimensional spectrum.
Right, that's all I'm noting. Because
Wait! We're glossing over too much, Jerry. Repeat what you just said about not fitting onto that two dimensional spectrum.
Well, maybe I should say one dimensional spectrum of left and right. It's
okay.
It's not going to fit anywhere on the traditional left-right continuum.
I agree.
Right, right. Which is...
Well, right, right. Wait, Rob. You say right as a transition.
I don't think it's on the left-right spectrum. Jerry's
arguing. You said that it was more left. You were like, yeah, I think this kind of goes along the lefty, you know, seems like a lefty argument. Doesn't really fit on the right there. So I think this is more of a lefty argument.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. That's the exciting.
No,
thing.
That's not what you just said.
That's what I mean. Maybe I'm not saying it. That's what I mean. I'm saying it's nowhere. It's not left or right. It's probably not even on the spectrum at all. It's probably a mix.
That is not at all what I first heard from you.
So I guess what I'm saying is, as a liberal thinker, I tend to classify concepts foreign to me as conservative thoughts. But this is not a conservative thought. I'm restating what Jerry says all the time, that the idea that might makes right, which seems to be a tenet of the right wing, is it doesn't work in the Jerry worldview.
No.
Right. And he says what does make right is what's just right, which sounds much more like a squishy liberal thing.
Wow. Way to pat yourself on the back there.
No, I think I see what you're saying, and I tend to agree that, you know, when the jury that I'm talking about here looks at the case and, you know, they feel the victim's pain and they find in favor of the victim, you know, then that's kind of the squishy liberal thing you're talking about, right?
I guess what I'm trying to say is that I feel like one of the things that defines a liberal worldview is that just because you have the most might or strength or power or background or friends or whatever it is, doesn't give you more rights, I guess, in a Jerry, to use a Jerry term. Strangely enough, to me that sounds like kind of a basic tenet of life. That seems to be the battle we're having over and over again in our political realm. And so I think this is another interesting point about how for us, as we feel like we're trying to evolve as human beings, I think we're trying to evolve away from the animal kingdom and into some kind of higher plane of being.
Yeah.
I don't feel like, I don't, let me rephrase that. I don't think we are trying to evolve. We're trying to legislate to a higher plane of being, and it's not working.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that's driven by the people, lefty people like me.
That's the issue, and it's not working, but...
I probably agree with you that it's not working, that it doesn't necessarily work, but I understand what's going on.
You know the old phrase, you can't legislate morality.
Correct.
You've heard right. that, right?
And you can't legislate common sense, and you can't...
Well, you know, the thing about, I mean, that phrase, you can't legislate morality, it fits right in with what I'm talking about here. And it is true from this standpoint that if something is immoral, it's immoral, and you don't need a law to tell you that. So you can't legislate it in that sense. You know, if you write the law, okay, fine, we're going to write a law that says murder is wrong. Well, we all know that already, so the law is redundant, so you can't legislate that. But then if you're going to write a law that says murder is okay under certain circumstances... Well, that doesn't work either, because then the law is immoral, because it doesn't jibe with what we know to be morality. So, you know, whenever I hear that phrase, that's what I think. You can't legislate morality. Well, you're right. That's because morality exists independent of the law, and sometimes the law runs afoul of that.
Okay.
That's really, you know, the crux of what I'm saying here in this second principle. Is, you know, the law and what is moral are not the same thing, and they never have been.
And what one person's morality is doesn't always translate to the next person's.
Well, that's you know, that's another layer, I guess, deeper of this philosophical discussion is what is morality and how do we arrive at that? And when I say we, I mean, you know, the three of
humans.
Us in our culture with our background. How does our morality differ from, you know, someone who grew up in the Middle East, for instance, or China or Russia, or you know, just anywhere where the culture is significantly different from our own. Do they have a different morality, or is there some list of things we could come up with that we all agree on? You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, that's a good question. And maybe we're showing our common cultural upbringing, you know, by not having too many disagreements here. But like, I think listener feedback mentioned like the caste system of India.
Right.
Or slavery in the Bible, or slavery in the U.S. And I mean, you don't, I don't think you have to look too far to see people that would claim what their natural right was to own slaves, and the Bible lets them do it.
Yeah.
You know, or I was born to this family, and hence I deserve more than you because my last name is Ibrahim.
Yeah. I guess my reaction to that is. The fact that slavery is no longer allowed here is evidence of the fact that it's immoral. You know,
right.
That we are evolving towards a more just and moral society, for lack of a better word.
You should run that by the South, see what they say.
Well, as far as I know, there's nobody down there still holding slaves.
Right. But they would point to the downfall of society that a bygone past of when things were correct or something. I don't know. But I hear you. That's good. Maybe this is the optimistic show. We don't sound too optimistic. Yeah. Maybe it's a point that we're evolving to wherever our natural self is. And the Democrats are pushing that charge. That's for you, Jeremy.
Well, I've stopped listening. What?
All right, we're going to take a quick break and probably discuss a few things. We seem to be doing that a lot lately on our break. And then we'll come back and jump into our listener feedback. So stay with us. are back. We are going to read some of our listener feedback from the last episode, and we got quite a bit of it. Our old listener Eric is back and offered some comments. He said, "While I agree in principle with the all men are created equal statement, I don't think it's quite as obvious as you imply, and I don't think the implication of the right of self-governance necessarily follows. A couple of examples. Multiple societies believe in a caste system or divinely anointed rulers or a nobility. You are saying that all of these societies are wrong. That's fine, but I think you are falling into the trap of the illusion of asymmetric insight." And I'll put a link in the show notes to what that is exactly. That's according to Wikipedia, it is a cognitive bias that involves the fact that people perceive their knowledge of others to surpass other people's knowledge of themselves. The source for this bias seems to stem from the fact that observed behaviors of others are more revealing than one's own similar behaviors. So, you know, what are you saying?
Yeah.
We're judging these other societies as being inferior because they're doing these things that we have already determined to be inferior.
Yeah, that's how we roll. And, feels good.
Yeah, and
I think that's how humans are in every aspect of their life.
Yeah.
Well, that guy's wrong, but it's okay if I do it.
But like we said in the last episode, the self-evident truths listed in the Unanimous Declaration are apparently not self-evident. But that's not going to stop me from believing they're true or attempting to influence others to believe them. And that's kind of what I'm doing here. So,
hey, you're trying to influence me?
Yeah.
Get out of my brain.
Eric goes on to say, obviously newborns / young children are not capable of self-governance, nor are the severely mentally handicapped or clinically insane. So what you really mean is that all men of a certain age, maturity level, intellectual capability have the right to self-governance. So there's a bias or assumption in your statement. And I guess I would say that the age at which we draw the line for children is probably an area we could debate. 18 is patently too late, in my opinion. 5 is too early, but, you know, where do you draw that line? I could probably go as low as 12 without much hesitation. But
we need a test.
I don't know if I would call it a bias. You know, my assumption going into that is that everyone perceives the world in the same way. You know, we all have the same senses. And, it, you know, ignoring things like color blindness, of course. So... those that have their mental faculties impaired or they're unable to use reason, then those individuals should be handled on a case-by-case basis. I'm conceding his point that, you know, I'm not saying the mentally handicapped necessarily are going to be equipped to exercise the rights that they have as a human being.
Is that initiation of force to say that you aren't capable of exercising those rights? I've determined that you are not mentally capable.
Well, I think they have to demonstrate a pattern of behavior, first of all. I mean, you can't just declare them that way, you know. And, I mean, I think this has come up on the show before, actually, and it's an area that I'm not going to say I've spent a lot of time thinking about, but it seems to me that the family members of the person probably have the obligation to control them, to make sure, okay, you know, if they have violent tendencies, that they're not allowed to act on them, or if they're just, you know, if they're not capable of knowing right from wrong, then, you know, then they have an obligation to control that person because they can't control themselves.
Mm.
Is that initiation of force? Maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you have reasonable suspicion that that individual is going to hurt someone else in some way, then preventing that, you're not initiating force against them. You're defending somebody else from something they might do. I don't know. I mean, it's certainly an edge case, and I'm not...
See, something that I take issue with is something they might do in the context of our discussion.
Well, like I said, they have to establish a pattern of that behavior first. You know, a single instance of it is not enough to establish a pattern. It's still, you know, they may still harm someone, they may injure someone else, but it's that by itself is not enough to warrant preemptive action, I guess. Like, if you know every time you take them out into public, they freak out and they hurt somebody, you know, because they just can't be around crowds of people or something, then
okay.
Then you number one, you don't take them out in public around crowds of people because you know that happens. And then if you have to do that, you take proper precautions, you know.
Do they have to get to the point of hurting someone, or is it beat their head against the wall and fling their arms around? And if someone were next to them, they might get hit. Yeah. Is it?
I mean, it's anything.
So it's
anything that you would expect a reasonable person to not do, right? It comes back to that definition, the legal definition of what a reasonable person would do.
Yeah.
If you know, you have an expectation that they are going to act in an unreasonable way, then, you know, you have to do what you need to do to prevent that. But like I said, this is an edge case, and I'm not willing to concede my point based on it. I think these things are going to crop up, and you handle them on a case by case basis. But it's not a reason to, you know, negate the entire premise. But it is interesting. It's a great point he brought up, and you know, I think it's probably worth talking some more about in the future.
And it makes me think of the use of force being immoral is the tenet of the evening, and I bet we can all find enemies we have that we can point to of using immoral force. And it'd be, I think it's interesting to think of what kinds of people would classify entities as using force in an immoral way. You know, for someone of a libertarian bent, just the fact that you have to give some of your money to the government and they come after you with a gun, that seems like immoral force. Right. I think if you're a gay individual and you think the Republicans are passing laws against your lifestyle, you know, that goes the other way, where it seems like, boy, these right wingers seem to be all about the immoral use of force, and so maybe that's where you firmly sit and observe the chaos, is that you can tell, you can point out an immoral use of force without having it be attached to a party or a system of beliefs that's some platform.
Yes.
It's good. I'm seeing it.
Sounds like
good. It only took an hour.
I think, Jerry's scaring me a little bit. He's influencing me, I feel.
That's my goal.
Yeah, you said so much.
Eric goes on to say, if you accept evolution, then there's nothing, biologically speaking, separating us from the rest of the animal kingdom. So why isn't it all creatures are created equal? Why don't dogs or cattle have the right of self-governance? It may seem silly, but this is obviously what PETA believes, so you are calling them wrong, too.
I'll be the first to say, yeah, PETA is wrong on many levels.
Well, I think it's a stretch to say that animals and humans are equal on any measurable scale. So, you know, I don't believe that animals have rights. I do recognize our obligation to treat them in a humane way, but that means that we are anthropomorphizing them to a certain degree, and we're pretending that we know what they think or feel, but we really don't, and I think that's what it boils down to.
Does that have anything to do with negotiating, as in animals can't negotiate with us in a meaningful way? Law-abiding way? Am I really stretching it there?
No. I have read that argument before that, you know...
Really?
In order to have rights, you have to be able to claim them. Huh. Means you have to be able to speak.
Well, a dog can speak. But he gets a biscuit for it.
Where that breaks down, then, of course, is, you know, the infant baby human
can
speak, but we all recognize that the baby has rights, even though it can't claim.
Is that because we know it eventually will be able to? Is that like a pattern of observed behavior based on the other humans?
And maybe PETA believes that the animals will eventually, you know, talk to us, that we're going to find doctors who can translate what they're saying. I don't know.
PETA is the... PETA...
Why don't you like PETA? PETA's great.
PETA is not great. PETA is great. Like Michael Moore or the NRA or any other organization that is phony and takes up causes on a false premise or false pretense and doesn't apply their views evenly.
Sure, they do all that stuff. But they have the best sense of humor. The NRA sense of humor, not great. Come on, some of those PETA protests are classic, you know, dress up like a whale. I mean, it's awesome. And you don't think they know they're being like silly and outrageous?
Here's an article that came out about PETA this year. They have shelters, animal shelters, and it turns out there's a significant majority, something I want to say it was in the 90%. I'll have to try to dig up the article. But the animals they had were not adopted out and were euthanized.
Shocking.
Yeah.
But they're funny.
But they're hypocrites. Yeah, we're getting off the topic here. Go on.
Anyway, onwards with the listener feedback.
Eric says, Jerry, so you really believe that there's an active government conspiracy to hide the true nature of Somalia from us? Really?
Yeah.
I didn't really think you were a tinfoil hat kind of guy, but now I'm not so sure. He provides a link here to the CIA fact book. It says, it doesn't say it's a lawless land. In fact, and he goes on to quote from it. I won't bother reading all of that. It never describes it as an anarchy. And now you said whenever Somalia is talked about in the news, so the media are in on this conspiracy too?
Yeah, Jerry.
Well, okay, well, what would you say is the general sense of what Somalia is like to the average American on the street?
Well, it's a bad thing, but that's not what he's saying. He's asking you whether you think that the government and the media are all have an anti-government viewpoint that they're promoting together.
Well, okay, so the phrase failed state is used to describe Somalia quite often, is it not?
Sure.
Okay, where does that come from, if it's not from the media or the government? Who is using that term to describe Somalia?
Well, it's the media and the government, but you're saying there's some intent there because they're trying to cast aspersions on a stateless society.
Yes.
That's a crazy claim. Come on, Eric, write in again. Okay. I like it, though. It reminds me of PETA, sense of humor.
He says, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. Okay, first off, nice Star Trek quote. I sometimes use that one because it's a little more accessible than the one it's derived from, which is from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, which comes from the Communist Manifesto.
Right.
And
Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Kramer read that one.
So Eric says, but also, I think the Occupy Wall Street people would disagree with you. They obviously believe that the government is protecting the needs of the 1%, not the many. And you know what? I completely agree with the Occupy Wall Street folks. That is not at all what government does, but that is what they claim to do. So, yeah, I don't disagree with them there. Listener Nathan had this to say. I hate to keep harping on this. Some folks are going to say this is just a matter of semantics, but it's really more than that. Our rights, as in natural rights, are what it is right for us to be able to do. We have a right to free speech. We have a right to own fully automatic bazookas that have a bayonet lug and a scary-looking pistol grip. We have that right here in the U.S. We have that right in jolly old England, and we have that right in Undi Burundi. Rights are different than liberties. We don't have the liberty to own fully automatic bazookas that have a bayonet lug and a scary-looking pistol grip. Natural rights are inalienable, and the liberties associated to those rights are not inalienable, because an evil person can take away those liberties. All men are created with equal natural rights, but not all men have equal freedoms. If you confuse rights with liberties, you just add to the difficulty of the discussion. So this was in response to when we were talking about people around the world that are, you know, born into situations that are, you know, very unequal to our own situation under the U.S. Constitution. So I think what he's saying here is just because they're born into those inequalities, they have the same rights. We all have the same rights, but they don't have the same freedoms that we do.
Yeah.
And I know we spent some time talking about this in the pre-show, but and Jeremy's not in agreement.
Kind of biting my tongue a little bit because I think you could go round and round on this one. And
yeah,
he's, well, you, in one sense he's right, but it's also then rights. There's never a rights discussion. Then there's only a liberties discussion.
Yeah,
and it should be the Bill of Liberties and
the Statue of Rights.
Yes, and your Miranda liberties and. I don't know that I have a lot more to say about that, but
yeah,
appreciate the feedback.
Well, I know what Nathan would say to the Miranda liberties comment, that the Miranda rights aren't natural rights anyway, so that's probably not a good example.
How are they not? I have the right to remain silent.
That's true, you do, but you don't have a right to an attorney. And
oh, not I have a right to for someone to represent me if I bestow that upon them.
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
You have the right to a public appointed attorney that I have to pay for because you were out drinking, Jeremy.
Yeah.
You don't want to pay? I thought you loved paying for other people's stuff. That's the whole premise of your party.
Actually, I do believe in publicly funded attorneys. They all suck, though.
Wow. Man, disparaging I disagree with Rob there. I think we have fine public defenders.
I shouldn't have said that. Now I feel
bad. Oh, there's the liberal guilt.
No, it came washing over me so fast.
Man, you're just checking these off like a Pez dispenser.
Like a tidal wave. It's because I don't know any public defenders. If I did, I wouldn't have said that. See, I need more outreach with public defenders. I hope that doesn't happen.
Be arranged.
Right. Depends on how Friday night goes.
We'll have to see if we can find some that might come on and be guests on the show.
I'm going to be sick that week.
Okay. Right. We have some interesting links in the reading room for everybody to check out. Got 2 weeks worth that we've been saving up in there. And one I wanted to mention was the Rachel Maddow video from April 23rd, where she said, I think Ron Paul just won Iowa. That's a pretty interesting one. I'd recommend everybody watch that.
I've not seen that mentioned anywhere else.
I know.
That is alarming to me.
Yeah.
The discussion about Iowa, Minnesota, or was it Wisconsin? I think it was Minnesota, wasn't it?
Yeah. That Ron Paul's got half the delegates in both those states, and you don't see that reported anywhere.
No.
Another one I found very interesting, and given our previous discussions on the Trayvon Martin case, I wanted to point out this one, George Zimmerman, Prelude to a Shooting. Reuters did a really in-depth bit of investigation into the timeline leading up to the shooting. And you know how I said in a previous episode about how it seemed every day we were getting new details about the story that would cause you to just completely flip-flop on your opinion of who the bad guy was in the story.
Right.
This is another one. When you read this, you're going to flip-flop again. It's it's pretty interesting.
I saw I didn't read this article, but I saw a blurb about it that he originally started carrying a firearm because of a pit bull in the neighborhood.
Yeah. And it's actually a cop who told him to get the gun because he was going to just get pepper spray. And, you know, the cop that showed up on one of the occasions that he called the cops because the dog was, you know, intimidating them.
Yeah.
He said to the cop, "I'm thinking of getting pepper spray." And then the cop said, "No, don't bother with the pepper spray. It doesn't work on dogs." He said, "Get a gun."
Wow. All right.
Last link that I added there just today is talking about the five so-called anarchists that were arrested in Ohio attempting to blow up a bridge, allegedly. It's an essay on that story by a guy named Larkin Rose, who I read his stuff quite often. But he claims the whole thing's a false flag operation, which I think is interesting. I hadn't really considered that.
Wow.
But he compares it to the Oklahoma City bombing, which, you know, a lot of people consider was also a false flag attack. But
yeah,
that's an interesting one you might want to check out.
I want to point out on the anarchist thing, like this grammar foul of this headline. Like, I'm just not a fan of this wording. It's men unknowingly put fake bombs at Ohio Bridge. Like, was it the fake part, or did they not know they were at the Ohio Bridge?
You know, fake part.
Yeah, it's the misplaced modifier. They unknowingly put them there. Did they think they took away the fake bombs?
My objection to it, of course, is that they're being characterized as anarchists. And that gives us anarchists a bad name, but I guess I have to say that I'm technically an anarcho-capitalist. I'm not just strictly an anarchist. And, you know, ever since the World Trade Organization riots in 99 or whenever that was in Seattle, where they tore up everything in the city and, you know, they were blaming it on all those anarchists, it's, I don't know. You have to define your terms, I guess. And a lot of the people who claim to be anarchists don't really know what that term means. So I wish they'd stop using it.
I know loads of teenage boys that like to do the little A in the circle.
Yeah.
It's just awesome. So,
right.
Jerry, you need a new symbol that's less awesome.
We need a soundbite of Rob saying, "I know loads of teenage boys."
Yeah.
At one time I did. That's a long story.
I'll add that to the best of
show. Right.
You guys got any links you want to talk about?
I don't think I do.
Okay.
I've been slacking on my links lately. I don't know. The only one I put up was the no fly zone for the NATO summit over Chicago, and they're issuing shoot to kill orders for any planes that violate this no-fly zone. And the implication here is that that's more aggressive than normal.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with reading flight restrictions, and I think usually it's, well, we'll try to escort them out of the area, and if they don't respond, then you take action.
Right.
Here it seems like they're not going to bother with that first piece.
Now, when you say usually, do you mean post 9/11 usually, or has that always been the case?
I think it's always been the case. I'd have to do a little research, but even post 9/11, when they, for instance, the no-fly zones over the White House or the Capitol,
right?
Yeah. When planes violate that, they scramble fighters.
Yeah.
But I think it's still, you'll investigate that guy and try to force him out of the area, as opposed to get up, lock him up, and shoot him.
Yeah.
Lock him up. Force him out. How does that work?
You fly next to him and use your plane to either you'll bump into him, which would be risky for yourself, or he will respond as you pursue him.
I don't think that was going to work. I'm going to have to see if that would, I have to update those tactics. Can you fly over them inverted and flip
them
the bird?
Give them the finger?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can, but it only works against MiG-28s.
It only works against Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, I mean, there are established procedures. If you read in the FAR AIM, Federal Aviation Regulations, Aeronautical Information Manual for intercepting aircraft and what to expect.
Link in the show notes?
I guess I better, yeah. I'll just mail everybody a copy of the latest FAR AIM.
Okay.
That'll be fine. Use it for a doorstop.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We appreciate your time and your feedback, so give us a buzz. Let us know what you think, and we will see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.
As the hawk cripples the dove.